have a quorum. Call this meeting to order. I will move House File 0079 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. With that, Chairman Davis.
Thank you, Chairman Gunther. House File 79 is an appropriation of $250,000 from the general fund for the Minnesota Historical Society, specifically for Historic Forestville. Now, as you know, last year, in several bills, we had, I believe it was Chairman Seifert's bill, regarding taking six or seven historic sites that had lost funding and were on the verge of closing, funding them and helping them along. Historic Forestville has been open simply because of the very, very hard work of some of the people sitting here and many people in the communities of Spring Valley, Wyckoff, Preston, and all surrounding areas. They, if you will look in your packet, you will see that they have conducted fundraiser after fundraiser after fundraiser to keep this place open because of the cuts from the state. So what this does, and I hope you'll keep it for possible inclusion in your omnibus jobs finance bill, this would be an appropriation specifically for Historic Forestville, but we'd be happy to work with other legislators who have historic sites in their areas and in their districts. Now, on your agenda, you'll notice that Historic Forestville has Dale Evald and Carl there. Actually, then I was going to ask Dave Foster and Mark White to testify on nanotechnology, and they thought that probably wasn't going to work too good. So, so members, if you could just flip the testifiers there, that would probably get us some better testimony on the subjects at hand. So that being said, this is one of my more lengthy bills, as you can see, House File number 79, and I would like to turn it over at this time to Dave Foster. I think I'll turn it over to Dave, who has... Are you still the president?
No, I'm not.
He has been president. Oh, George Fogelson's the president. Past president and very, very active to this day in the operation of a historic Forestville. And I will turn it over to Mr. Dave Foster, if that's okay, Mr. Chairman, to introduce the testifiers.
Mr. Foster, welcome to our committee. Would you give your name for the record?
Yes, sir. My name is David Foster from Spring Valley, Minnesota. I'm here representing the Friends of Forestville. And to begin with, I'd like to thank Chairman Gunther and the committee for the opportunity to speak and testify today on behalf of Historic Forestville and all historic sites that are important to our state. First of all, introductions to my far right is George Colbinson from Grand Meadow. He's the president of the Friends of Forestville, has been for probably the last 5 years or so. Sitting next to me, Bill Keyes from the Minnesota Historical Society, manager of historic sites. And my far left is Mark White from Spring Valley. He is the park manager of Forestville State Park. The historic site is located within the Forestville State Park, so there's a close connection between the Department of Natural Resources and Minnesota Historical Society with this facility. So with that, I'd like to start out, if I may, maybe give you a brief background of what is Historic Forestville. Historic Forestville is a community that was founded in Fillmore County, one of the first communities in 1853 when the territory was opened up. The Meehan and Foster families were some of the first to come to Forestville, and Robert Foster, Felix Meehan, started the first store in Fillmore County there in a log cabin. May I get the connection, Foster? Yes, they're my ancestors. Robert Foster, started the store. Felix Meehan was a brother to my great-great-grandfather Major, who also came and started the first hotel in Forestville, where Ignatius Donnelly stayed a few times in his visits to Forestville. Major Foster also was the first representative to the first state legislature from Fillmore County, so I feel very privileged to be here testifying on behalf of my ancestry and my great-great-grandfather who started the career when the state was young in the first legislature. I'm very proud of that. And just you know, the people that are involved in Historic Forestville, there's a lot of ancestral ties, and they're all very proud of the history of Forestville. Over here at Forestville, Forestville was a town that started, and like every other settlement, tried to grow, people came to and settled. The problem was in the 1870s, the railroad bypassed it, went to Preston, Lanesboro, right off in Spring Valley. So the town started on decline. To get to the cut of the story, the Meehan family ended up owning practically everything in Forestville, the store, the businesses, me and family hired people to farm the land, run the store, and so the town survived somewhat. What's important about historic Forestville and the story we tell there is the story of rural agriculture. This was after the town was surpassed by the railroad and began to decline after it had inhabitants of close to 200 people. It became primary agricultural venture for Thomas Meehan and his family, and also the store to supply local people with supplies. They hired everyone. People in this community worked for the Meehan family, and they were paid by credit in the store. They weren't paid by cash. They were paid by credit. What we portray at Forestville now is 1899. This historic site has the original buildings from the store was built in 1857. It's there, been restored. We have original artifacts from the Meehan store that was left there in 1910 when Thomas Meehan closed it, locked the doors up. In the 1960s, the DNR acquired the property for a state park. Those artifacts are still in the store, and they're still there today. The ones that aren't used at the site are stored up here at over at the History Center. A very, very unique collection. All the records from day one of the store were intact and still there. So we teach there at Forestville on this historic site to the visitors is a way of life back in the 1890s, and how the farming operation worked, how the store worked. Agriculture is still the number one industry in the state of Minnesota. Historic Forestville is one of only two sites in the historic site system that has a living history program that teaches agriculture to the citizens of the state and the students in the schools. Very important. It's a very hands-on program. Very highly accredited. A lot of compliments on it from people. The kids learn a lot. Adults learn a lot. For us to lose, to have reduced programs and lose this kind of a program is, I think, very hard or very detrimental to our state as far as education of a history. Where we come from and where we are. Visitors to the site and kids don't just learn about farming practices and store. They learn life lessons on responsibility and hard work and how to be successful because this, you see that with what happened there. The Friends of Forestville took a very big interest in this in 1986 when the site was originally closed. Worked hard on legislation and funding to open and to reopen the site, which Representative Davis worked hard with us and the other legislators, and got this up and going again. And we don't have a lot of cash down there, but we have a lot of people that work hard. The Friends have, I was looking back yesterday, it's interesting, kind of going through things. It's been probably about 8 years since we've been here to testify. And I was going back through the old information and the old videos, and I'm looking at the store and the old barn and the other buildings, and there was no paint on them, and they were falling down and dilapidated, and you know, we got funding to help the legislature to open this back up. And we look at it now, and the buildings are all fixed up and painted and new roofs. And our organization, along with other community organizations and community members, helped to do that. We roofed buildings, we painted the buildings, helped the Minnesota Historical Society along with this project. Been a lot of input from the local community on hard work. Like I say, we don't have a lot of money, but we have a lot of people that want to work hard to make this a success. So we look at it as a joint effort that way. Also looking through that, as I mentioned, a lot of ancestral ties. In the 14 years I've been working on this, there's a lot of the members that worked on this that aren't with us anymore. A lot of older residents that had ties to that. And it's very important, I think, that for us and for us as a state to keep these memories of these people and their hard work and their dedication and what they did and what they wanted to portray for our needs in education alive with this, because well, even though they're gone, they worked hard at this. And you know, I'm, as you can tell, I'm very adamant about that and really dedicated to that. So, you know, what Greg has asked for and Representative Davis is funding. We've got a reduced program down there, and we've done fundraising efforts locally, and
tomorrow?
It's easy to do that for a year or two, but it's not sustainable. And we need more help on that. And what I would like to do is let President George Corbinson speak to you on our fundraising efforts and give you a background on that. We have some phenomenal figures and stories for you on that. So if I could, let George speak, please.
Welcome to our committee, Mr. Culberson. We give you your name for the record so the Historical Society will know you are here 100 years from now.
Yes, my name is George Culberson. I am president of the Friends of Forestville. I'm also an interpreter and have been an interpreter for 12 years at Historic Forestville, and I live in Grand Meadow. A little background on this. As you know, in 2003, with the cutbacks that the Minnesota Historical Society had, they decided to close 7 sites in order to meet the deficit that they had. So the Friends of Forestville didn't want that to happen, so we stepped forward and said, we will be the spearhead here to try to raise the money to keep this place open. And for 2 years now, we've been successfully able to do that. First, let me say that most of the money that we've raised has actually been from individual donations, everything from $5 to $5,000. We have had donations from people from not only Minnesota, but a number of different states, visitors who have come to the site and visited us and may find out that we're in financial trouble, and they'll drop off a donation. We've also had an anonymous donor in the Twin Cities who has given us a $50,000 matching grant, which helped us along. And we did a number of fundraisers. We held 2 different pancake breakfasts in Spring Valley at the Servicemen's Club, and most of the food was actually donated, so almost everything we made at those fundraisers were profit. We held 2 different basket socials at the historic site. We got Walmart to donate some biscuits. I got Subway Sandwich to donate some Subway sandwiches, and we got one of the local grocery stores to donate some fried chicken at cost. And we put together 50 baskets, and we auctioned them off for as much as $100 a basket on the site. We did those 2 different years, and they were very successful. We've done 2 raffles. We had a quilt raffle, and we also had a raffle for an original watercolor painting of Forestville, which was done by one of the interpreters at the site. On Veterans Day, or close to Veterans Day in 2003, we did a Veterans Day dance in Rochester, Minnesota. It was a 40s style dance, swing dance. We had a number of people dressed in World War II uniforms and that sort of thing, and worked pretty well. We had something called Playing Dress Up, the Stories and Clothes of Our Lives. Our former site manager's wife does a program in which she has different costumes, and she puts on different costumes and tells different stories, and that was very successful, and that was held in Wyckoff. We brought in, during the summer, we brought in Zeno's Carnival of Culture. It was a traveling 1890s medicine show. We brought that in and did that down at Historic Forestville. We did 2 different nights in pizza places in Spring Valley, and Chatfield held a Forestville night for us, in which they donated 15% of the proceeds that night to us. That was in Chatfield and Spring Valley. We held 2 dances. One was a spaghetti supper, a dance, a live and silent auction. That was this last, just a few weeks ago. And we also had another one earlier in Grand Meadow, another dance and auction. And so those were held in Grand Meadow. We have had, there's a race course close by, the Deer Creek Speedway, and we've had members go over in costume and sell 50-50 tickets where you get 50% of the purse if you have the winning ticket. We've done that several times. Let's see, what else? Am I missing anything? And we've raised, in 2 years, about $189,000 in all in doing these fundraisers. Oh, I also, I should mention a big one. We just got over $1,300 from the Kingsland Elementary School in Spring Valley. They did something called Pennies for Preservation. And they brought in pennies and nickels and dimes and quarters and a few $20 bills, and they, and this is a very small school, folks. Rural, you know, Spring Valley is not very large, and I don't know exactly how many students there are, but it's not a very large school, and in about 2 weeks' time, they raised over $1,300 for us. The middle school found out about this, and in 2 days, they raised $100, and there is a Lutheran school in Wyckoff that raised $55 doing the same thing. So, as you can see, number one, we've been holding fundraisers in various locations, Spring Valley, Wyckoff, Grand Meadow, Chatfield, around the area. We've also had various groups help us out on this, the American Legions and VFWs in Spring Valley, and it's been a real effort by a lot of people in southeastern Minnesota. And for our auctions, this last auction, we had over 200 businesses donate various items for us to auction off. So we've had a lot of people help with us and raise this money. So the big problem is it's getting more and more difficult to do that, and we cannot sustain that. We simply can't keep doing this. We put in thousands of hours of volunteer work on this project, and the big problem is going back to people a second and third time. You really don't want to have to do that, and so we really need some help to keep this important site open, and I guess that's about all I have to say about it. So I'll turn it over to Mark White, who is a park manager, and he will speak to you a little bit about how important the site is because of the school tour situation that we have there. Mark?
Welcome to the committee, Mr. White.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Mark White. Today I'm representing the Friends of Forestville. But I'd like to share with you what I see every day in my job there, working at Forestville Park. Forestville, for those of you who haven't visited, the park is very diverse. The historic village is only one part of it. Mystery Cave is another key feature of the park. And we have wonderful attendance by our schools now for field trips. And we find that of those 2,500 to 3,000 school kids that come to visit the park each year, two-thirds of those are coming on the bus and spending time at Historic Forestville for their Minnesota history, but also spending time at Mystery Cave. And it's a very effective program because there's an efficiency in transportation, and kind of kill two birds with one stone as the kids come. And the programs have worked very nicely together, and they're very closely coordinated programs. We do the scheduling for those programs through the main park office there to create efficiencies in the schedule there. But we see a very great response, a very high return rate from the schools, very positive reaction from the teachers for both programs. And if we see the elimination of a program like Historic Forestville, there's a great impact on the school programs for Earth Science and Mystery Cave, as well as our average park visitors that come throughout the year. So we think that the whole package is really a unique aspect of Forestville, and you know, the historic site, no question, is a very important resource for the kids, especially within that 70 to 80 mile radius. But we also get groups as far school groups as far away as the Twin Cities.
Mr. White, how far away is Mystery Cave from Forestville?
Well, the cave is actually part within the statutory boundary of the park. Physically, the cave entrance is about 6 miles from Historic Forestville.
How many visitors does Mystery Cave have?
Last year we had just shy, about 20 shy of 19,000 visitors.
And Forestville, same number or different number?
No, actually, last year I believe, I haven't got my figures right here, but I think it was around 9,000, but we did have a reduced program. Remembering that that was under a reduced program where you didn't have as many days as we've had in the past. Over the 13 years of Forestville's existence, it has averaged over 13,000 visitors a year.
Thank you. Could you tell me, Mr. White, what's the average week? What do you do for an average week in Forestville? I've never been there. I'm going to look forward to going there someday. But
well, are you interested in attendance or income? Or
What do you do?
Oh, what do I do in my job?
Mm-hmm.
It's a very difficult question. my position description is about 30 pages long. So generally administering, supervising. We have about 30 staff working in the park. About a dozen or 15 of those are interpreters at Mystery Cave. So these are professional staff. We take care of a large physical plant, including about a $3 million physical plant at Mystery Cave. So lots of maintenance activities. We have one of the highest occupancy campgrounds in the southern Minnesota parks. And so we're mowing every week about 15 to 20 acres of grass, maintaining 73 regular drive-in campsites. The busiest horseback park in Minnesota with 60 horseback units. We're about triple the attendance of the next busiest horse park in Minnesota. And so with that comes a lot of supervision, budget work, purchasing, you know, the typical things I guess any middle manager would do in the state of Minnesota.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Add something to that. I want to make sure there's no confusion here. Mark White is the manager of the park, which is run by the DNR. Mm-hmm. Historic Forestville, of course, is Minnesota Historical Society, and we have our own site manager. Mm-hmm. So I just want to make that clear.
Fine. Mr. Foster, kind of like your family, my family founded Mankato in 1848. And it's kind of interesting to study the history. Some good, some bad.
Well, I think all families have that.
Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for being late. So you may have discussed this, but have you gotten any corporate sponsors to help?
I'll take that one, I guess. We come from a very rural area, and we don't have much in the way of any large corporations close by. The closest we would have would be Rochester or Austin. We tried to get the support of the Hormel Foundation. Hormel is basically only interested if you are located in our county, and Historic Forestville is located in Fillmore County. We tried to get the Mayo Clinic involved, we tried to get IBM involved, and we basically have gotten no place with any of these corporations. We have really tried, and my wife and I also sent out over 50 applications, grant applications summer before, and received only one small grant from one area that none of the big ones we couldn't get. So a lot of them said that they it was their policy not to fund things that had been lost their funding through legislative cutbacks and things like that. We got all kinds of reasons why we didn't get any money, but we have done we really tried to get grant money, we really tried to get corporations. But like I say, down in southeastern Minnesota, I don't know if you know, very familiar with it, it's very rural, very agricultural, and some of the poorest counties in the state, actually Fillmore County is one of the poorest counties in the state. We don't have much for corporations, but we've looked and we've tried and we haven't been able to get any.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, no, I'm from Owatonna, so I know this very well, but I was just thinking, I know Farm America, for example, is goes through a lot of the same thing, and they have looked at areas that would be like areas or in-kind type of things, and so they have been working on that and have been fairly successful, and so that it might be worth to keep trying.
Well, we do keep trying, but it's reaching a point where we just don't think we can continue to raise the money that we need. Frankly, some of us are getting very burned out doing this.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, This is a historic site through the Minnesota Historical Society. We have a brand new visitor center there. We have a brand new visitor center. Mark White's the park manager over there. And so the facilities are there. It's just that we need to put some more money in there, and the impact that this has on tourism for the area is very substantial. If I could turn it over, I know we're going over time here. If I could turn it over to the gentleman from the Historical Society to make a few comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bill Keyes. I'm the Director of Historic Sites and Museums for the Minnesota Historical Society. I'm really glad to have this opportunity to come before you and talk about Historic Forestville. I think that the description of the program there and of the site you've already heard, these people know this site intimately. They spend a great deal of their time there making sure that it's operating well. Everything from painting the fences to cleaning the buildings, they are dedicated to this. But their problem is that they cannot continue to raise the funds for this site. The Historical Society had named this, along with six other sites, on a list 2 years ago of ones that we were having a very hard time with because of funding. And restoring this funding would make a big difference. It would allow this site to stay open. Right now it has a very limited schedule, and it would be a terrific thing to be able to reopen the site with a larger schedule, and I think that would help their attendance because they are running on a limited timeline. I also wanted to take this chance to thank the people of the area surrounding Forestville, because they have dedicated so many hours of their time to raise funds for this site. It means so much to them. They have worked really hard, but they can't keep going back to the same sources over and over again. And they're finding that the well is now dry, that they've gone to so many times, and they really need help. Thank you.
Gravel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question. Does the name... Patrick Flynn, does that show up at all in the history of Forestville?
Yes, it does. My family is related to the Flynn.
Oh, if we just could have got a picture of that right there, that would have been great.
My bosses and Flynns are related through marriage about three generations back. I actually have contact with a Flynn family that lives in Farmington. And 2 years ago, we started having foster family reunions on the larger four generations back. There's a lady from the cities here, Marcia Kramer, that did genealogy on the foster family and got us all together. So we go back to Robert Major, all the people that came and the Meehans that came. And a lot of Flynn show up for that from around the country.
Yeah. So, Chairman, very quickly, just said, so Patrick Flynn actually built this facility then, or built the hotel there, right?
One of them, yep.
Yeah, okay. So, George Flynn.
There were actually two hotels at one time in Forestville, and the Flynns did indeed own one of them. It's unfortunately that it's no longer there, but we have the store ledger, and the name Patrick Flynn appears several times in the ledger.
Yeah. I'll just really quickly, Mr. Chairman, just so everyone knows, George Flynn lives in my district, and he actually contacted me about a week ago. Apparently there's a Friends of Forestville newsletter that goes out, so your communications are being received, and the Friends are doing what they're supposed to do.
Would that be from George Flynn from Farmington?
Yes, okay. He's actually down in Florida, right?
I know him very well.
George is a great guy.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I knew that Flynn would get the Mahoney's going for you.
For what one?
The mention of that good Irish name Flynn would get you.
Oh, no, sir. It's that's the only thing that's keep me awake today or keep me alive today is the antihistamines. No one wants to be around me. No one wants to shake my hand today at all. Yeah, thanks. Just a question for Mr. Keyes. How many sites does the Historical Society operate? Historical sites. How many historical sites does the Historical Society operate outside of the main museum here across the street from us?
The Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, the Historical Society is responsible for 30 historic sites around the state. Some of those are not open to the public and are just being kept for the purpose of preservation. We operate 16 historic sites. There are about five more that are operated in conjunction with other local, county, or friends organizations as well.
Representative Mahoney.
And, Mr. Keyes, do you have budget numbers that would tell this committee how much? I can't remember what your budget is over at the Historical Society, but how much of your budget goes to the historical sites, whether it's 30 or 35 or 60?
In round terms of state funds, it's approximately a third of the overall appropriation, which is down to around $23 million.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing no other questions, Representative Clark.
Just a quick question. Did you tell us what the charge was for admission to the site?
Last year it was $4 for adults, $3 for senior citizens, and $2 for children under 12. And I'm not sure if there's a rate increase or not this year. I thought there was going to be, but I'm not sure. Do you know, Bill, whether there's a rate increase?
There is not an intention to have a rate increase. I should tell you, we have different rate structures for different historic sites and for different facilities. That's based upon essentially the kind of size of the program. If you go to the History Center here in St. Paul, you're going to have the chance to see a half dozen exhibits and some pretty large programs. If you go to Forestville, it's a much more modest program. And we try to calibrate the fees according to that.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Clark.
Is it based on a per capita visit? Or I'm wondering about is, like, I know we have a number of bills before us, the Kelly Farm and others. So how do you actually come up with that number? Because I think the Kelly Farm charges more, and I don't know if they have more visitors or less.
It's based, well, we have a tiered system, essentially, is what it is. The History Center and Mill City Museum in Minneapolis, Fort Snelling, and Split Rock Lighthouse are all considered to be Tier 1 and have a certain program level, a certain visitation level, also have, an iconic status in the state, and those have a higher fee. And there are two levels below that, and there's a second and a third tier. They're based on a variety of factors. Visitation isn't one of them, but it is more on the size of the program. Basically, we're trying to make sure that when people do visit these sites and they've paid their money, that they feel they got their money's worth. And so ones that have a more modest program, we charge less for them. Mm-hmm. Ones that have a bigger program, we charge more.
And Mr. Chair, could you just remind us how long we've had any charge at all for these sites?
Since before my time? since the 1980s.
Mr. Chair, I thought that at least maybe at the main History Center we didn't just have a charge.
There was a charge, Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, there was a charge initiated just recently at the History Center here in St. Paul. We have continuously, since the opening of the History Center there, charged for quite a number of special programs, but in terms of a general admission fee, that was what was initiated just in the last few months.
Maybe if I could just look at get a copy of that Tier 1, 2, 3, it would be helpful.
I'd be happy.
Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, I will renew my motion to have House File 79 laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
And Representative David's House File 639.
Dale and Katrina first.
I will move that House File 639 be possibly included in an omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 639 has to do with the Rushford Institute of Nanotechnology. The group you just heard from Forestville has very big hearts, very big dreams, very big aspirations, and they do a wonderful job in down in historic Forestville. What we're talking about here is something that's really small. It's really small. Nanotechnology, the technology to, I'm not even going to try and describe it. I've got good people around me that can do a good job at that, but Representative Mahoney recently at a meeting, we were able to get some bonding funds passed through the bonding committee, passed through the House of Representatives. We did it last year, but of course what happened last year, well, let's not get into that. So the money was there last year. This committee has heard presentations from this group before. I know there's a lot of new members. And as a First Amendment, we're asking for $1.4 million. Representative Mahoney was concerned that I wasn't thinking big enough or asking for enough money, so if we could put a one in front of the one. I'm just kidding. we'll think small here. It's nanotechnology. So, no, what we're doing here, Rushford, Minnesota has for years been working on the Rushford Institute for Nanotechnology. And I will let the folks here, we have Dale Evovald from Rushford, and we have Carl Wittenden and Alice Zimmer. And we have also with us in the audience the president of the Southeast Minnesota Technical School. Did I get that name right today? Okay. The president from that institution is here supporting it. We have a tremendous amount of support in southeastern Minnesota and across the state for this to be developed in Rushford. And I worked with Representative Mahoney in the past on some of these issues and the chairman and other members of the committee. So with that, I will. There's about $600,000 in the bonding bill that's going to conference committee. That is for actually the physical structure. What we're coming to this committee for is for equipment to get a grant for equipment to be used. And I'd like to turn it over at this time to an attorney from Rushford, Mr. Dale Evovald, who has worked on this project for many years.
Evovald, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm reading from the Rushford Institute for Nanotechnology, a Minnesota nonprofit corporation that we call Rentech. And we've registered the name, by the way. I'm Dale Evovald, the secretary of the corporation. I'll make some brief introductory comments on the bill. And appearing with me today, doing most of the talking, will be Carl Wittenden and Alice Zimmer, who are also members of the board of directors of Rentech. Also here today in support of the bill is Morris Kinneberg, who is on the board of directors, Jim Johnson, the president of Minnesota State College Southeast Technical, I got it right, and Harlan Jacobs from Genesis Billing Centers, who is one of our consultants and has been with us from the very beginning. My interest in this project comes primarily from being a small town attorney for the last 35 years. My belief is that the practice of law is meant to help people stay out of trouble and to help organize their affairs and personal lives in a legal, efficient, and progressive manner. That's my philosophy in the practice of law. My law practice, however, has taught me that that's not always the way it works. I always knew that bankruptcy was something that attorneys did. I did not expect it to be a major part of my business from time to time. The 1980s and the farm crisis led us into a bunch of bankruptcies, which were primarily farm-related, and it also affected a lot of other attorneys around the state. There were bunches of farm bankruptcies at that time. I did not expect the bankruptcy business to continue after the farm crisis kind of passed us by, but we are finding right now that there is an endless supply of people that cannot pay their necessary bills to support themselves and their family. The income levels in our area are not sufficient to support an average family under any kind of financial stress, so we end up seeing them to file bankruptcy. Statistics from the U.S. Census Department tell the story quite well. The latest numbers I'm able to get over the Internet show that Fillmore County, where I live, has a lower income than the state average. Fillmore County is $17,067 per capita income in the year 1999. The state average is $23,198. That's $6,131 per year that we don't have to spend. A lot of money. The Census Department also reports that private non-farm employment in Fillmore County dropped by 5.2% from 2000 to 2001, a one-year drop. The state at that time gained 1%. Alice will show you some numbers from Deed that show some of the areas where the employment was lost. Other things that affect our area is that we have a much longer than average time of travel to work. This probably is because our residents have to leave the area to find a decent job. Another result of the economy in our area is that we are short of highly educated people. Fillmore County has 15.1% of its people with a college degree. The state average is 27.4, nearly twice as many. To me, this indicates that people are looking for a better job by leaving the area. When I moved to Rushford in 1970, my wife and I thought we had really come to heaven. The area is beautiful with bluffs, hills, woods, rivers, wildlife, and wonderful people. The local bankers at that time told me that the area had a very strong farm-based economy and that Rushford had the third largest bank deposits of any city in southeast Minnesota. Today our economy is related to manufacturing, and it is in a shrinking position. We have lost over 400 jobs in the Rushford community itself in the last several years. The population in that area is about 2,400 people. When I heard about nanotechnology and what it is and what it may do, I became quite excited because this may be the way to resurrect our rural areas and prevent our residents from moving away. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Carl.
Welcome again to our committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman Gunther, members of the committee. Thank you for inviting us to testify on behalf of this very important project in southeast Minnesota. My name is Carl Wortinen. I just give you a little background on me so you know where I'm coming from. I'm an electronics engineer, graduated from a hockey college out east called Clarkson University and long time ago. Spent the first third of my life working as a design engineer and then the last two-thirds in management positions. All of it in doing product development work on things that was always breaking new ground, always developing products and the underlying technology at the same time from the NASA projects like the Centaur booster system to fuel sensors and electronics for Atlas Centaur rockets and the lunar lander electronics through to gigabit per square inch recording heads for disk drives in the disk drive industry where I've spent most of my career. I know quite a bit about working in small dimensions, so nanotechnology has been a real interest to me. My personal interest in this, I started with Rintec about 11 months ago, and it came about primarily because I spent all but the last 5 years of my career up in the cities. And during the last 5 years, I personally have seen about 600 jobs disappear between Rochester and Winona in just the two companies I was involved with, and my jobs were part of that. We've seen a number of high-quality jobs disappear. So when I saw Rintec come about, to me, it's a cause really worth working for to bring high-quality jobs to rural Minnesota and the surrounding area. So with that, I have a lot to cover here this morning, and I will try to go through it as fast as possible. The agenda, I'm going to talk about what Rintec's opportunity is. Last time Kevin was here, he gave you a good overview. I'm going to refresh a little bit of that overview, talk a little bit more in detail about the services we're doing, and then the funding plan, where the money that we hope that will go and how it will tie in with other funding that we'll receive. Also, we'll talk about what we think some of the expected outcomes are from having a Rintec in Rushford, and wrap it up with a conclusion. Uh,
As you know, RENTEC is a nonprofit organization. It's intended to be a business incubator. We're basically going to serve clients developing products based on nanotechnology. You know where it's located. You can see the mission up on the screen up there while everybody's been talking. We are the first rural nanotechnology business incubator in the country, no pun intended. RENTEC's opportunity is basically in implementing the National Nanotechnology Initiative. If you have a chance, if you're interested in nanotechnology, go to www.nano.gov, and this is the federal government's program for pushing nanotechnology, basically, in a correct manner. They have four basic goals. RENTEC is implementing all four of the goals of this initiative, and that's something that most other nodes and centers around the country are not doing. Many focus on maybe two or three of them. But we believe that all four are appropriate for where we are and what we're trying to do. Those initiatives, then, basically are the following. The first is to conduct research and development to realize the full potential of this revolutionary technology. The second is to develop the skilled workforce and supporting infrastructure needed to advance this research and development. The third is to better understand the social, ethical, health, and environmental implications of this technology. And that's a critical one because so many times in the past, technologies have come forth and we haven't controlled it. And this time the government is actually trying to have a plan in place whereby the people doing the work understand the implications and the ramifications of it before it gets to a point where it's doing something we don't want it to. And the fourth is to facilitate the transfer of these new technologies into commercial products. And that's kind of where the rubber meets the road because that's what grows our economy. And that's certainly probably the key part that we're interested in. There is a new industrial model coming about with nanotechnology. It's called the bimodal model. It shows that because the cost of developing of the capital equipment required to develop nanotechnology is pretty expensive, that most likely companies will need to or choose to locate their research and development with the manufacturing. We will not have, as is so often now, R&D located at the headquarters or in a particularly nice location with manufacturing located somewhere in a rural area because the labor costs are cheaper, or offshore now as so much of it is. Our strategy then is in keeping with these goals that basically Part A is manufacturing jobs will be close to the research and development. If you bring that research and development to rural areas, you'll bring the manufacturing jobs. It's that simple. So in implementing their goals, we will provide the infrastructure for developing the research and development. We will work with our educational partners to educate the workforce. We will inform the community so that they know what's coming, and the result is that we'll have economic growth in rural Minnesota. And talk a little bit about what validates this strategy. First of all, we're following the NNI's goals, which have been in place now for over 5 years and have brought this country from a catch-up position to a leadership position in nanotechnology. That's in the global competition. So their goals are valid. Our implementation is very straightforward. The bimodal model has been recently validated by Dick Sommerstad in our conversations with him, and Dick is the director of the University of Minnesota Business Development Center. And we also know that there are going to be more incubators like RENTEC. For example, the University of Wisconsin at Eau Claire is already funded an incubator based on the model that we're using. In fact, they kind of copied it from us, but they already have the funding in place to go. So that's a validation of our concept, and we also have some competition between the states, and Eau Claire is not that far away.
Now, a little bit about our services, how we meet this opportunity, what I refer to as actually executing the National Nanotechnology Initiative's goals. First of all, our services. Our services are designed to meet their goal of conducting R&D to realize the full potential. Some of the principles that we're founding this service on is to reduce the cost hurdle for startups. Again, it is very expensive to capitalize a company for all the equipment they need to work in nanotechnology. Even if you want to just prove a concept or develop a prototype, you need expensive equipment. So here's a quote from a consultant in San Jose, California, who is in the nanotechnology area. And he, I just want to call your attention here to the fact that the real estate facilities expense is the second largest line item after personnel. And down here, that because of the specialized nature of the improvements. This is not your normal manufacturing plant you need. It's more like the semiconductor industry where you need clean rooms and tight control of the spaces and special materials and so forth. So it's expensive to start up, so we want to defray that cost and help entrepreneurs to get going. Secondly, we are choosing a deliberate general focus. We've been getting pressure from places where we've talked to foundations for funding and such that they want us to specify an area of nanotechnology. This is what we're going to focus on. We're choosing deliberately not to do that, which is kind of unusual. And the reason that we're doing that is because we believe that if we have multiple non-competitive R&D efforts going on in our facility, then we're going to see some synergies between those engineers and scientists. And what will that do? That is effectively going to increase the brain power for each company, which means that they all have a better success of succeeding. You get a couple of engineers or scientists over coffee, and it doesn't matter whether they work for the same company or not. They're going to kick around some ideas, and they're going to help each other because they like to solve problems. And so that is just a real fact. This is also going to make it more attractive to VCs because they will see that they're going to get more bang for the buck, basically, because of this kind of synergy going on. So that's why we are not focusing on that area. Now, all efforts basically require analytical equipment. So we're going to focus our initial resources on analytical equipment to support these entrepreneurs and companies. The equipment to actually develop products, produce the products, will probably vary, and our clients will have to fund that for the most part, unless we work something out. But the analytical part we'll fund, and that saves them a great deal of money when they're in their early cash drain stage. Some other features that Rintec has is that we have a lower cost of living, a relaxed lifestyle. We have cultural and educational features in the close cities. We have an underemployed workforce, and this gives us a lower cost of doing business. What this means, basically, is that Rintec will provide services to the clients at rates that will make it attractive to develop businesses in Minnesota and in the surrounding area. The next area is our business services. These are designed to facilitate the transfer of the new technologies into commercial products. And basically it comes in two areas. First of all, manufacturing expertise. We'll provide the resources and guidance to make that transition into production. We'll provide training and labor, access to consultants. This will keep the cost of scaling up as low as possible. Then in the area of business itself, we'll provide effective, efficient business services at a reasonable cost to these clients. Many of our clients probably will not have business background, but they will have access to business expertise, and neither Rintec nor they will have to pay the associated high overhead. These areas will be marketing, financial, venture capital, planning, project management types of resources. Our third area, then, is the educational services. These are designed to develop a skilled workforce in supporting the infrastructure needed to advance R&D. Any companies that come out to work in our facilities and then graduate to produce a manufacturing plant are going to need employees. and so we're working with our partners to do that. Our initial partner is Minnesota State College, Southeast Technical, and Alice Zimmer and Jim Johnson have been very, very supportive of what we're doing. They're developing a two-year nanotechnology curriculum. President Johnson was just named to our advisory board. Students from their school will train in our laboratory, saving the cost to them of creating technical labs and putting equipment in. Their graduates can work as interns with our clients, and that way the interns get state-of-the-art experience and our clients get skilled labor at a lower cost and a future source of employees. We will be working with other educational partners. We started to work with Winona State University. They're developing a four-year nanotechnology curriculum. Efforts with us will help launch that initiative. And we'll work with any and all two- and four-year institutions in the nation to put in place a program and work cooperatively with them to provide training or whatever resources it takes. The fourth area, then, is our societal impact services. And these are, again, designed to better understand the social, ethical, health, and environmental implications of the technology. We believe that an informed community makes better life decisions. So our community needs to understand how this nano revolution is impacting this region. So we'll inform the community through community education programs. We'll be encouraging all kinds of educational opportunities. We'll engage children and youth with technology so we get some interest in math and science and hopefully get them to go into engineering or scientific careers to make sure they have good jobs. Secondly, we believe that an informed company makes better decisions. And again, we will inform them about how the nano revolution is impacting their industry, their particular niche in their industry, their market, and their supply chain. And if they don't understand how to work within this revolution, they might find themselves on the outside not being competitive. So in recapping our goals then, we are dedicated to reversing the job loss trend in the region. And at this time, I'd like to turn it over to Alice, who is going to talk about our seed data that we have.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Alice Zimmer, and I'm on the board of directors for RINTEC, and I'm also part of the math faculty at Minnesota State College, Southeast Technical. Briefly, I want to mention the work we're doing in conjunction with SEED. Our regional analyst in Southeast Minnesota, Arta Broadchester, is working with us because we want to look at jobs in rural Minnesota, in southeastern Minnesota, and how that is impacted by nanotechnology. The BEAD representative would say that this is difficult to put exact numbers on because nanotechnology is not only a change in product, but it's a change in process, too. So we are looking and working with them closely on our quarterly census of charts. And the type of industry, we're comparing the industry numbers from the year 2001 to the year 2003. What we're finding in looking at material and having Deed do some of the research for us is that we're seeing that nanotechnology, as you know, crosses all kinds of disciplines, chemistry, physics, biology, medicine, and engineering, but it also crosses all kinds of industries. So that's a real key part of what they're seeing that we need to do, that this is very different from what we've seen in the past. One of the things we're seeing in the charts and the work that Deed is researching for us, and it validates what we can see, is that Deed's profiles show that Southeast Minnesota industries fit some following applications of nanotechnology. They fit materials applications with desirable properties. They fit information technologies such as quantum computing and computer chips that store trillions of bits of information on a device as small as a head of a pin. It supports medical advances and environmental benefits. So that was very validating for us to find that their research backed what we saw happening in southeast Minnesota. Industries, we're finding, will either utilize or benefit from nanotechnology. Their research includes many of the industries that will do both, and I think that's an important concept, that you'll either utilize it directly or benefit from it indirectly. It does not imply, as they say, that all industries will employ people skilled in nanotechnology. It could be that way, but it could be that they're also reaping the benefits of it also. Textiles is a good example of that kind of industry. An important statistic that has come out of our research is that the percentage of jobs that BEAD has documented for us from 2001 to 2003 has decreased dramatically in southeast Minnesota. The decrease in that two-year period in these documented areas is almost 4,000 jobs. So we know that that's something that job development and industry development in nanotechnology can reverse statistics that are indeed this alarming for our area. This is an example of several of the charts that we've been working from. And if you see on the left, we have titles of different employment industries. And we also have access under each of the categories to every single business and particulars about the businesses in all these areas. So we have immediate access to reach these people and industries and work with them. One of the things that the literature review from BEAD suggests is that nanotechnology hubs are the most popular local strategy for building a nanotech presence, building on strengths they already have in industries that we already have. Southeast Minnesota is documented as having a strong industrial base rooted in manufacturing and in healthcare both. And we in particular can really tackle that strong manufacturing base. BEAD is further stating that it is not hard to imagine that a few key employers could help build the nanotechnology of our entire region in southeast and south central Minnesota. Two of the things we're doing right now in working with what we're doing and in conjunction with the experts that we're drawing from, such as BEAD, we are surveying right now 250 southeast Minnesota businesses through the custom training at the Technical College, and we will have those questions back within the week. And we're asking them three questions. Are you aware of the National Nanotechnology Initiative and the implications for your company? Instead of each company investing in maintaining and upgrading equipment, would you be interested in accessing central locations in Minnesota to do that? And would you like to be included in these initiatives? So those are the types of questions that are part, samples of the questions that are part of a large questionnaire that we're ready to start working with soon. And the last thing is that part of our group's effort, when we find out some of this information, we will be going to the businesses and industries and doing some profiling for them. We're going to profile them for nanotechnology information for what they need to do as their next step to keep viable in today's market. Now I'll turn it back over to Carl.
Thanks, Alice.
We have two more bills to go yet this morning.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman, for running long here. I'll try to hurry through this last
Appreciate
part.
Appreciate it.
Basically, I will skip over this, but I want to point out that the state's already bought into nanotechnology, basically in several areas, and we see that to fund RINTEC would continue in that precedent and offer a real opportunity to grow rural Minnesota. Now I'm going to talk about our funding plan. I'll go through this as quick as I can. Our initial budget is $6 million. We're looking for authorities from state, federal, and private sources. We expect to be self-supporting within 4 to 5 years. And critical to a committee like yours, we don't intend to come back for any additional state or federal funding once we get this initial funding. Our startup year is 2005. Our business plan covers 2006 through 2008. We are in the process of putting together the finishing touches on that. The board needs to review it. We're working to an overall five-year plan. Our capital equipment is planned to require approximately $4 million for the initial startup. The total annual payroll will start under $300,000, going to $500,000 by 2009. The state funding, as you know, consists of the two bills, the one that we were here for before, for $600,000 to purchase, renovate, and construct the facility that will house Rintec in Rushford, and the current one we're talking about for $1.4 million. $1 million of that is intended for equipment. The $400,000 will go for the operating expenses. Looking at the equipment, it's going to support all four areas of the initiative. We'll be purchasing analytical equipment, sample preparation equipment, computer network and workstations, scientific software, and office equipment. All of the equipment that this money will go for will have a useful life of between 5 and 10 years. For example, that will include things like scanning, tunneling, electron microscopes, atomic force profilometers, various optical and X-ray diffractometers, and ion milling systems. This overall, our lab will be similar to the University of Minnesota Characterization Lab. Basic analytical equipment does not become obsolete rapidly. Our financial plan allows 5 years for our revenue flow to begin to replace or upgrade our equipment as required. We will also take advantage of market conditions by buying used equipment that is not technically outdated. To do that, we'll have a window of about 6 months during which we'll search for used equipment before we'll buy new. The $400,000 will fund the operating expenses, our personnel plan goals, calls for minimizing overhead costs so that we can deliver the best services for the lowest cost. Our initial management team will be a president slash CEO and a vice president slash COO with an administrations manager, a laboratory manager, and some of these will be part-time until we have sufficient funding to pay them on a full-time basis. Other staff will be hired as demand requires. This will include lab technicians and office support staff. We will outsource not just some functions, but every function that we can, we will try to outsource to keep the overhead down low. And, of course, being in rural Minnesota, our costs will be lower for many of those functions. We'll have consultant services that we'll pass through at no cost, no additional cost to our clients. That way, it'll avoid overhead costs for us and for our clients. The private funding we're looking at, we're going after grants of approximately $800,000 this year and an additional $1.2 million next year. The state funding will make us highly eligible for foundation grants, so it's really important that we get the funding from the state. Everything that we do, both federally and privately, kind of hinges on the funding from the state. Some of the operating expenses the state funds will cover will include grant writing. Federal funding, we've been invited by Senator Coleman's office staff to write a bill for the $2 million, and that also will fund both equipment and operating expenses. Now I want to just mention the outcomes, regional benefits that will likely exceed estimates. It's hard to predict what's going to happen, as we all know. But I just want to give you a glimpse here of what the return on the investment of your of Minnesota's stake would be. This is a leveraged return on the state's $2 million, and it ranges from 3.5% to 17% over 5 years. That's obviously a very wide range, and the 3.5% is kind of the pessimistic approach. Here's the assumptions. We got $6 million in funding. We have 10 R&D clients at full capacity by 2009. It takes 3 years to make the transition from prototype or from concept to manufacturing. Business statistics show that 10% of startup companies are successful. One company could generate 10 to 50 jobs in 5 years. I believe these are very conservative assumptions. Annual salary, average salary of $35,000. So given those assumptions, then, plus business that range of 3.5 to 17%. The 3.5 is if there's only 10 jobs per company, and the 17 is if there's 50 jobs. Now, the federal government's sector growth estimates of the nanotechnology area has been consistently conservative, underestimating it. So this is probably a pessimistic estimate. We think our success rate should be better than that, because we're going to provide a reduced cost of startup that reduces the risk to the entrepreneur. We'll have a technical environment that will provide synergy between clients, as I mentioned before. We'll have the business services. These synergistic ideas might save some clients from failure that would outside and by themselves could fail, so we might save some. So we think that a 20 or even 30% success rate is not impossible. And if you look at that, then the return on investment of the $2 million by the state of Minnesota could be as high as 34% or even 50%. Now, you can't get that kind of return just any old place. And, of course, on top of that, there's a multiplier effect. Manufacturing businesses have an economic multiplier. Other businesses benefiting will be office equipment, business services, home builders, banks, educational institutions, shops, so forth. You know that. Workforce outcomes. We'll have 2 to 4 year graduates that will get high paying jobs that we will generate in the region. Clearly, the jobs and industries will be transformed by new technology, and our job is to help raise awareness to that in schools, companies, public forums. No one should lose their job because they didn't see it coming. In conclusion, we, the USA, state of Minnesota, and large, small communities are on a cusp of this huge and inevitable change in our society and industries. So we must act positively and proactively, or we will not reap the harvest that is possible. RENTEC's objectives are in concert with the National Nanotechnology Institute Initiative, the state's economic growth objectives, and will provide concrete mechanisms for economic opportunity to happen right here in Minnesota. Thank you for your attention. I apologize for running over so long. We don't have handouts of this presentation, but if you would like it, we would get them to you.
Very well. Representative Davis, there's an amendment here.
Mr. Chairman, I've talked about your amendment, and I would find it very friendly.
Okay. With that, who was
not very
Mr. Chair.
Kind
of. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I should have had my name on there. It is very friendly.
Very friendly.
Sure. Hey, basically explain what it does so members know.
Yeah.
It may already be covered, but there wasn't anybody from Indeed to ask. So it basically says that all these wonderful things that are claimed in terms of jobs and wages and all of that will be in a report that's reported to us once a year. So like a one-page report, and it tells us that your goals and wages that you wrote originally and said to the public, this is a good reason to invest. Here's what we delivered. And we've had it's been a bipartisan effort for years, and I just want to make sure this is covered under it.
Very well. All in favor of Representative Clark's amendment to House File 639, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment passes. With that, I renew my motion to have House File 639 be possibly included in an omnibus bill as amended. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Thank you.
Representative Westerberg.
I'm
going to ask a question. Sign in here.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 1197 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
And since we've heard this a couple times, maybe we can get the short version.
I will do that, and we will certainly proceed that way. House File 1197 is a bill appropriating $250,000 to be used for grants requiring matching funds to promote employment and economic development through the use of broadband technology. The definition of broadband would be described as always-on high-speed internet connection that allows users to download and manage large files and data quickly and easily. I believe that broadband development is a necessary tool for continued success for rural Minnesota, and this is an excellent public and private initiative to encourage further success. The numerous benefits of broadband technology include the potential to retain jobs, grow new markets for business, strengthen the healthcare delivery system, better educational access and opportunities, and an improved quality of life. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll introduce our testifier here today.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Gary Fields. I'm with the Blindman Foundation. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I'll keep my comments brief because I believe I've covered a lot of this material already in a previous presentation about broadband. Our activities are guided by a strategy board. It's a public-private partnership. We have the CEOs of a half a dozen broadband service providers and state and local leaders. We've identified that one of the most important things for economic development in greater Minnesota is the expanded use of broadband-based technologies. We found that much of the state has service, but very few people use it because they don't know what to do with it. Our Get Broadband program is an educational program that shows businesses, schools, governmental agencies, healthcare organizations, and the general public what you can do with broadband in order to be more effective and productive. The foundation has committed $250,000 to this effort. We've just started it this winter with awards to seven communities. With the funds that we have available from the foundation, we feel we could serve probably around 25 communities. With additional state funding matching the foundation's investment, we could double that coverage, and we think that would have a great impact on greater Minnesota. The program, just in one sentence, we set some goals. For connectivity within the community with the community leaders, we conduct a bunch of activities that demonstrate the applications of broadband-based technologies to all those different sectors. We measure our progress and our results so that we can show what was accomplished, and we hope that you can support this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Any questions from the members? Looks like you've informed everybody very much. With that, Representative Westberg renews his motion to have House File 1197 be possibly included in the omnibus bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, President.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mulley. Welcome to our committee. I think Representative Clark would love to move this.
Sure, I would like to move House File 1046, please.
Yeah. For possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Representative Mulwick, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members. This is called the Minneapolis Learn to Earn program. It provides job training, life skills, and education programming for disadvantaged and at-risk youth in the city. Since its inception in 1986, there was over 4,000 kids who have participated in the program. It's been funded by a combination of park board, state, federal, and private monies, foundations, nonprofits, etc. The bill summary, I think, refers to the fact that it was started in 1995. It was actually started in 1986. And the state was first involved in 1995. It was a smaller program before the state became involved. The bill would continue funding at the $250,000 a year level, the amount that was received for many years. Most years there are actually more money put into the program by other sources than by the state. In 2004, out of over 1,300 applicants, only 124 were able to participate in the program, unfortunately because of lack of funding. The participants in this program, they attend weekly academic classes and receive tutoring. They receive job skills and life skills training.
They're mentored by role models from within their own communities. They earn their own wages, and they perform routine maintenance and recreational assistance work in Minneapolis parks. I've actually gone out to these work sites and also to the classroom sites and talked to the youth involved, and I have no doubt that there's a lot of effect on our program to help these at-risk youth stay out of problems and improve in their schoolwork. They've told me about that. The funding last year came from the Park Board, the state, and nonprofits and foundations. This program serves the students ages 14 to 18. 72% were blacks, 14% Asian, 5% American Indian, 1% Somalian, and 1% Hispanic. And this morning, Mr. Chair and members, we have with us Linda Tachik, who runs the program, Sean Hockett, Valerie Starr, who have been in the program, and Commissioner Rochelle Berry Graves from the Park Board.
Good morning.
Oh, one other thing, Mr. Chairman, I have copies of the, to hand out while she's speaking, of the different years showing the different funding sources, all kind of very many groups that have supported this over the years.
Very well. Welcome to our committee. Give you a name for the record.
Linda Tachik. I'm the coordinator for the Park Board's Teen Works Program. He told you very much the basics of the program. I guess one of the things that's different about our program is that all the youth that are involved in our program are referred to us through community-based youth servicing organizations. So they know the kids that need this program most, and we get those applications in and process them. There's a funding guidelines. Almost all of these kids are from low-income homes. They meet at least one of 11 at-risk categories that is identified by the Department of Economic and DEED. And they do work and earn their paycheck. It's not just given to them. One of the benefits of this program is that we make sure that they are responsible. They learn the basics. They know they have to come to work every day. If they can't make it in, they have to call in. We give them the basic training that they need to succeed not only in the job at the Park Board, but in future employment endeavors. It's worked out really great for a lot of youth. We have a lot of supportive staff that have been with the program since almost day one. Once somebody becomes involved in this program, they want to continue. It's that satisfying, and you're really making a difference to the kids in the community. I don't know much more than I want to say. We're very lucky to have with us, a couple of the past participants. Sean Hockett can, I guess, take it now and tell you how his experience was, and Valerie, and then if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Give you a name for the record, please.
My name is Sean Hockett. You know what, the reason why I'm here is to help support this program, and there's a few key words I keep saying. That word is opportunity. In 1988, I was given the opportunity to become a youth worker in Teen Works. With the opportunity, I was given another opportunity to become a seasonal park keeper trainee. And I was given one more opportunity to become a full-time park keeper so I can support myself and my family. I was also given the opportunity to help run this program. And then recently, I was given the opportunity to be a full-time crew leader or a supervisor of a crew of 10 to 12 full-time employees with the Park Board. So this program gives kids opportunities, and it gave me an opportunity. If I didn't have this opportunity, I would have the opportunity to be a drug dealer or to be on the streets causing trouble or robbing and stealing from you guys sitting before me. This program is very important. I look at $250,000 as petty money. You can employ 50 kids with that $250,000, or you can incarcerate 10 kids. What is more valuable, incarcerating 10 kids or employing 50 kids? And in my opinion, it's more important to and play 50 than incarcerate 10. So this program is not only is important, but it proves that it works, and I'm the ultimate example of how programs like this actually help kids and help people become successful, taxpaying members to our community instead of being a burden on everybody. I think that's really important that we realize that this is, it's not just about giving me a job, it's about giving me opportunities and giving me something to goals to work towards and accomplish those goals. And I've done those things, and I'm just started. I'm still trying to attain a few more goals in my life. And because of this program, I was able to take those steps. And it'd be a shame if you guys decide to cut this, because it's really important to kids in Minneapolis, and I'm a perfect example, and so is she, and she'll let you know what she feels about the program in a second here. But remember that word opportunity. It's all about opportunity for kids. That's all it's about. $203,000 is nothing. That's zero. That's petty. That's pennies to all you guys here. Pennies. Nothing. Let's spend that money and help kids instead of hurt kids. That's what I'm here to say. That's it.
Welcome to our committee.
Welcome. Thank you. My name is Valerie. In 2003, 2004, I was a past participant in this program. And this program helped me a lot. It helped me earn money, you know, keep up with my school skills. It taught me how to save money. Started a savings account, and it kept me busy. They kept me out on the streets, like Sean said, and kept me out of trouble and all that. And for that, it also helped my family, helped me get my school, you know, school supplies and school stuff like that. And that's all I can say about it.
It's pretty good.
Thank you.
Representative Gazelka, you got a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know, Representative Mulley, I'm not sure who this would be directed to, but it sounds like you track what happens to the kids after, because you guys are back here today. So is that something you do for all of the children that get into the program, and do you get to see then what happens to them, what kind of impact this program has? And then secondly, just a question, are they able to come back a second year, or do you then find another group?
They're able to come back after a second year. Some of our youth workers have problems in school, limited English, and so, you know, we're more easy to get along with as far as, you know, offer them a job in some other places, you know, give them a chance to mature a little bit more before they go out into the workforce, you know. Once that happens, you know, we encourage them to, you know, take that next step and, you know, find a, you know, different employer so that somebody else can come in and have this opportunity. As far as tracking, we don't really have, go out and track them, but being that they're in the parks, it's part of the community, we tend to see them as the years go by. I mean, we're out there every day working in the parks, and this is where they live and play, and so we see them all the time and kind of keep in contact that way.
Mr. Chair, I think you know, having it measurable, I think, is something I would add to this, just so you can kind of see what impact. I mean, I can see the impact, but I think having it measurable is a good idea.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gazelka, I know they're, I don't think she explained it all. They do have tracking on that to some extent, I know of even, in that their test scores in both math and reading, 100% of them achieved higher scoring. There's some other similar studies that I know of that were done. I don't know all of them, and I'm not sure who at the park board does the tracking, but that one hit me because I've never seen a program like with that record of 100%.
Last question, Mr. Chair. Lastly, do you help them then make that transition as far as getting other jobs outside of your area?
Yeah, we continue to support them even after the program is done. They always know that we are a reference for them. If they need help filling out an application, our doors are always open to them for assistance.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rochelle Berry Graves, and I'm one of the commissioners on Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board. I've been a commissioner for 3 terms now. My day job that pays the bill is one as a career probation and parole officer for Hennepin County. 33 years ago almost, I started my career in this building. And I worked here the year the building was bombed.
Huh?
But I sit before you today with regards to this program first to say thank you very much for the support that you've given us in the past, and ask you again to assist us in assisting the family and the children in Minneapolis through summer employment and job development and assistance with their education. My overall purpose when I first came to the Park Board and requesting that this program be expanded was because of my concern about the number of kids that I was seeing when I went over to visit my friends over in juvenile, the number of kids that were in the detention center. I mean, when I'm hearing about kids who are 8 years old, 8 years old, 8 years old being expelled from school, and I, as an adult agent, understanding and knowing the impact, the psychological impact that has on a child who's 8, who's trying to get to the point that you and I are in our life's journey, we want to encourage them to have positive and hopeful experiences and beliefs for themselves. And that was the purpose in the board's expansion of this program. We were the ones that had the most contact with the kids during the summer months, and really during school year too, because they come to the park after school for their programs. But we're the only thing basically going on a regular basis in the summer for young people. And I wanted to make sure, and the members of the board wanted to make sure, that we had something available to them and to their parents that would help their parents who were working these minimal income jobs keep those children busy. You and I know that the busier kids are, the more they don't want to run the streets at night. They want to go home. I always tell people, my ultimate goal is to have the children say, "Mom, Dad, I want to go to bed." And so if we can keep them busy doing something productive where they feel good about themselves, I think this will assist us in developing responsible young people that can take our place as we retire so that we can have a nice retired life. But if we don't assist them, those of us who live around them, the communities that help support them, if we don't assist them, it's not going to happen. You and I didn't get here on our own. There were a lot of people in our lives who guided us down the path. And this is what I'm asking you to do again this year, to assist us in aiding young people as they go on their life's journey. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really can't say it any better than it's already been said, but I want to thank the witnesses for coming and testifying and just saying this is such a fabulous investment. Even in the past that has no real buildings for kids to go and learn to earn is there. The youth are there. They're fixing up the equipment. And I think what Valerie and Sean would indicate too is once youth have been involved with a park, This is ownership that protects that park in a way that you can't put a dollar figure on it. And we have lots of graffiti and lots of other things to deal with in our park, and it's great to have the land-earn youth, you know, feel their own sense of ownership. And so, Mr. Chairman, I hope we do not do what the governor wants us to do to eliminate this program. It just pays back so much more, as has already been stated, than it ever costs us.
We'll endeavor to see what we can do.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Representative Mulready, thank you very much for bringing this. Representative Clark renews her motion to have House File 1046 be possibly included in an omnibus bill. Thanks for the wonderful testimony. And with that, this meeting is adjourned in time.